Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, cancer. For decades, Dr. Azra Raza has cared for those suffering from the disease. An oncologist at Columbia University, she's closely tracked our country's war on cancer, noting medical breakthroughs, but also watched as the price tag continued to grow, as well as the suffering of her patients and their families. After being both doctor and wife for her husband as he was dying of leukemia, she became convinced that modern medicine is getting it wrong. Dr. Raza is now out with a new book. It's titled The First Cell and the Human Costs of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. Dr. Raza, I must tell you that this book is one of the most powerful and sobering I have ever read. You offer a very downcast assessment of just how little progress we've actually made in the so-called war on cancer. Tell us why you believe no one is winning that war.
Diane, I want to begin by saying that the whole purpose of writing this book was exactly what you have summarized in a sentence, that our current cancer paradigm is simply not good enough. It is failing our patients. Anyone who has advanced disease, really the outlook is not very much different than it was 50 years ago for those patients.
Wow.
And my fundamental question, Diane, is that why are we still using the same slash-poison-burn approach to treat cancer after 50 years?
Slash-poison-burn. Explain what you mean.
That is a way of calling chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and surgery by basically what it does to the patients. And despite spending billions of dollars in trying to develop better treatments, all we have managed to do, except of course few cancers which have done well with other treatments, two obvious examples are chronic myeloid leukemia and acute promyelocytic leukemia, and a few others, except for those where targeted therapies have worked, mostly we are relying still on chemo radiation therapies and surgery.
What surprises me about what you've just said is that throughout the years, we have heard so many exciting announcements. There's been talk about precision medicine, talk about immunotherapy, CRISPR techniques, and other advances. But apparently, as you point out in The First Cell, not much help for most cancer patients. Then why has there been all this excitement about new breakthroughs?
I have been treating and studying cancer for now 35 years at least. I have to say that right in the beginning when I started treating and studying acute myeloid leukemia, particularly deadly form of cancer, I was full of hope and excitement. I am an immigrant. I had just come to America as a young person wanting to find a cure for cancer, and acute myeloid leukemia was one of the deadliest. And after treating patients for about 6-7 years, it was very clear to me that in my lifetime, this disease will not be cured. Yeah. And so I turned my attention towards trying to prevent this disease from occurring and studying patients who present with a kind of a pre-leukemic state. These patients suffer from a group of syndromes called myelodysplastic syndromes, and a third of them can develop into acute myeloid leukemia. But since 1977, Diane, I have been regularly hearing about cures for acute myeloid leukemia also just around the corner. Why? Because animal models have shown improvement or cures. So as one of my colleagues is very fond of saying, Azra, there are a lot of healthy mice running around with acute myeloid leukemia. But unfortunately, for the patients, and this is the killer, that I'm still using the same combination of two drugs, popularly known as 7 and 3, because we give 7 days of one, 3 days of the other. The same 7 and 3 since 1977 to 2019.
You're saying in the book that animal studies, including those on mice, are not only misleading, but they're actually harmful for cancer patients because the disease can't be accurately reproduced in animals.
Yes, and I would like to specifically clarify something here, because I'm so concerned that I will be misunderstood when I criticize animal models. I have said it over and over in the book, and I would like to clarify it here on your wonderful podcast also, that what I'm criticizing is one aspect of animal studies. Animals are a wonderful model as long as we use them as tools to study biology. But once we start thinking that we can give a drug to an animal, see its effect in the animal, and then immediately extrapolate the results into humans, that's where my problem is. So I don't think animal models are good for drug development, but they are very good for other studies. So I'm not criticizing everything else. And we must continue studying animals for those kinds of purposes. But yes, they are misleading and they are harmful, actually, to what happens in humans. And I stand by that statement.
Why are they harmful?
Well, for both reasons, that if we find something has worked in animals, we try it and bring it to the bedside and it doesn't work. And the patients suffer all the side effects of and toxicities of the treatment we are giving them, but none of the benefits. And on the other hand, the converse is true as well, that if a drug fails in mouse models or any animal model, and we just don't even bring it to the bedside. And there have been instances, I have quoted in the book as well, that some of the drugs could work in humans, but didn't work in animals.
Dr. Raza, what you seem to be arguing is that too many researchers are looking at the cancer once it has already shown itself. What you are arguing is that researchers, doctors must go back and look not at what is displayed, but rather at the first cell. How in the world can doctors do that?
Actually, I'm saying a couple of things. One of them is what you said, that all of our efforts right now are directed at trying to eliminate every last cancer cell from the body. And that takes its toll on humans. But before I get into the first and last cell, Diane, I'd like to also emphasize that one of the reasons for me to write the book is that we as oncologists who are charged with protecting our patients and trying to prevent their suffering from the time of diagnosis until their death seem to have somehow become a little muddled in our practice today, because we are treating disease and illness as if they are synonymous. They are not. One reason which compelled me to write this book is that we need to bring back that paradigm where we treat illness differently from disease. Disease is something doctors study and diagnose, but illness is the holistic effect of that disease on the patient at so many fundamental levels. And this is why it becomes very important about the kind of human cost of chasing after the last cancer cell. We are trying to kill every single cell, but what are we using? It's like somebody said, using a baseball bat to hit the dog with it to try and get rid of its fleas. So if you have that kind of draconian measures to kill minimal residual disease, then you end up hurting a lot of normal tissue and normal cells and the individual. And those are my serious concerns, that the current paradigm of cancer research and treatment is failing our patients at so many levels. But, you know, there is that apocryphal kind of story about the frog. If you throw a frog into boiling water, it will jump out. But if you put it in cold water and slowly start heating, the water it doesn't realize and will die without jumping out. I feel like that's, even though scientifically incorrect, the story has been quoted many times and proved wrong scientifically, but it makes the point that we have become desensitized because of accepting little absurdities one at a time. For example, can you imagine how much drugs are costing these days?
I am reading about that daily.
And how have we come to this obscene point in our practice, where 42% Americans lose every penny of their life saving after 2 years of a diagnosis of cancer? 42%.
And you point out that of the cancer drugs approved during the past two decades, 70% of them were at best useless.
Sadly, yes.
That's really a shocking fact. And it makes me wonder whether, in fact, what doctors are doing is experimenting on patients with whom they really are not talking about the fact that these drugs could be useless and could indeed cause more harm than good.
I'm sorry, there I completely disagree with you, Diane. I hope you won't mind, but honestly, in my 35 years in America, I have yet to meet a single oncologist who didn't deeply care for the patients. Our styles may be different, but believe me, I have never met anyone who would harm knowingly anybody or experiment on patients. The whole thing is that all oncologists are desperate to do something for their patients.
Even though it may not work.
But we tell the truth to every patient that it may not work for you. In fact, we give all the statistics. In fact, they're given consent forms to sign, which has everything in black and white. But on the other hand, given the frailties of human nature and our desperation when cancer strikes, I mean, think of a 22-year-old boy whose story I recount, Andrew, in the book.
Yes.
His mother would tell me all the time, if there's one in a million chance, Azra, we want to take it.
Ah.
So it's not fair to say that we are experimenting on patients or offering them drugs without them knowing. They know it. I mean, 90% of the time, stark truth to the patients. 10% we may use language that may sound like jargon. But everyone tries to convey. And as I said, patients are given consent forms and they have Google to fall back on these days. So they really become well informed, and yet they go in trying to take whatever is available with the hope that there's a slim chance at least for them to respond.
Tell us what happened to Andrew. Tell us his story.
Actually, Andrew is the reason that basically finally pushed me to write this book, because Andrew is a 22-year-old boy, my daughter's best friend, this beautiful young man that has been coming in and out of my house since 15 years of age.
Huh.
My daughter's traveled with him all over Europe, four best friends, Rebecca, Charles, Shehrzad, and Andrew, going to Amsterdam, to Montreal, to Paris and London for vacations, you know. All the time studying hard, partying hard, whatever kids do these days. One fine day, he develops a weakness and pain in his arm, and very rapidly it gets to the point where he's rushed to the emergency room, and within hours he's quadriplegic.
Ah.
And neurosurgeons find he is suffering from one of the most aggressive, malevolent cancers known to man, glioblastoma multiforme. And it was a 9-centimeter tumor, which could not be completely removed. So now from the get-go, we know that this young man's chance of survival is 0.00. But you know what happens, Diane, is he, as soon as he opened his eyes from that surgery and was told his diagnosis, he turned to his mother, Elena, and he simply said, "Mom, don't worry at all. Just call Azra. She's on the cutting edge. She'll find the cure for me." How do I look at myself even in the mirror, Diane? Because I had nothing to offer this poor young man. No, sorry, not nothing. In the 16 months it took this boy to die, what did we do to him? Multiple surgeries, placement of a shunt, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, immune therapy, more chemotherapy, more radiation, more immune. His whole mouth and esophagus, one raw open wound the whole time. He couldn't swallow at the end. He couldn't move anything. He's quadriplegic. And his mother and his sister have to stand, and his father and his grandmother have to watch this happen every day. The last thing I'll tell you about him is so, so painful, but I want to voice it because suffering is what I see on a daily basis, and suffering is what I write about in the first cell. Because until and unless we go into the granularity of this suffering, we won't be pushed to really try and change the paradigm. Imagine he's now just turned 23. Couple of weeks before dying, they brought him a form to sign, which is a DNR, do not resuscitate form. 23-year-old, how is he to say, "Don't resuscitate me"? He told them to go away, he's not signing it.
Huh.
They left. That evening, his father came to relieve Elena, his mother, and Kat, his sister, who had been with him all day. As soon as his mother and sister left, Andrew called back the attending who had brought the form and said, "I'll sign it now." I couldn't do it because in front of my mother and sister, they wouldn't be able to handle it. Even this 23-year-old is being protective till the end of his mother and his sister. Why are we failing Andrew? And how many Andrews will it take to change? This is the question I asked myself, and this is why I wrote this book, because I couldn't talk about my late husband who died. I took care of him for 5 years, but it took me 18 years and Andrew to shake me into writing about even Harvey.
When we come back, more from Dr. Azra Rabza after a short break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Dr. Azra Rabza. She's an oncologist at Columbia University and the author of a new book titled The First Cell and the Human Costs of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. Harvey was your husband, and as you said, you took care of him for 5 years. That must have been so difficult for you as a doctor to try to care for your own husband.
Yes, that is something I don't wish on anybody.
Did that mean that you saw cancer and treatment and the hope for cure in a new and different way as you watched over your husband and eventually watched him die?
I don't think it changed me as an oncologist and as a doctor who takes care of patients, but it changed my perception of the whole world completely, taking care of Harvey. I'll read you just two sentences from the prologue of the book.
Please.
Because Harvey was suffering so much from this lymphoma. As swelling subsided in one joint, it popped up elsewhere without warning. Fresh lesions began with a tingling, burning sensation, becoming bright red and sizzling hot within hours. Nomadic lymphoma cells meandered autonomously, rudderless. They wandered the body with studied carelessness, entering and leaving organs at will, disgruntled, edgy, exploring possible niches in various organs, rejecting some, settling in others. As we watched the drama unfold, Harvey from inside, I from the outside. The lymphoma marched on its aimless, monomaniacal journey into irresolution with a motiveless malignity. Cancer is what I had been treating for 2 decades. Yet, until I shared a bed with a cancer patient, I had no idea how unbearably painful a disease it could be. That's what I lived through with Harvey for 5 years. When he was diagnosed, our daughter was 4 years old, barely, and died when she was 8. But it was Andrew and Omar, the younger people, and all my patients that I'm losing now on a weekly basis, who finally have pushed me into accepting that we need to do things differently. At least we have to accept that the current strategies are not successful, as successful as we'd want them to be, and that a change in strategy is called for. Now, I'm not saying that instead of chasing after the last cell, if we turn to early detection, this is an easy solution or that it will be the ultimate solution. No, but we all understand that prevention is the best cure. Anyone who has cancer, you will hear them say, oh no, but it was caught early, so it's taken care of. So we know early detection is good and taking care of cancer early is good. It's not cancer that kills, it's the delay in treating that kills. Point is, why would someone who's 22 at Andrew's age would be even screened for having cancer? Since no one is immune, since children get cancer, the answer is that we need to have constant monitoring of the human body as a machine. Instead of having sporadic and periodic annual exams and checks, what we need to do is continuously look for and try and identify, detect, and eliminate abnormal cells.
Did Andrew have any signs before his huge and unbearable symptoms appeared?
This is why the human body is such a complex thing, Diane. We think we know our bodies, we know nothing about them. A cancer can spread to stage 4 and attack practically 90% of an organ and we won't know. Andrew had no symptoms at all until just 2 or 3 weeks before when he started developing pain. How many people do you hear of right now? The whole country is mourning for what is happening with Alex Trebek. He didn't realize he has stage 4 pancreatic cancer. He looks fantastic. He looks beautiful. Had no idea that cancer is growing inside him. And so this is where I feel that we have to turn our attention towards studying humans, towards trying to identify this disease as early as possible. And for this purpose, I have been committed to early detection since 1984, when I began to turn my attention and focus on pre-leukemia and following my patients as they develop leukemia. And the one good thing that came out of my being an immigrant and a foreigner is that I was too naive. Had I grown up in this country, once my mind was made up to study pre-leukemia and leukemia, I would have developed or tried to develop an animal model for it. But having come from Pakistan, it helped me to be naive. And I said, if I'm going to study patients, I better save their samples. And so in 1984, I started to save blood and bone marrow samples on my patients. And today, this is the largest tissue repository in the country dedicated to patients with pre-leukemia and acute myeloid leukemia, which has been collected by a single physician. I have now more than 60,000 samples from thousands of patients, and not one single cell has been contributed by another doctor.
So what you're saying is that this collection of samples can indicate to you who it is who might develop a blood cancer later in life?
This is exactly what I'm saying, Diane. Because I have followed these patients from a pre-leukemia, some patients took a year to develop acute leukemia, others haven't developed it in 20 years, and I have serial longitudinal samples on these patients. Now, if we go back and look at thousands of these patients, by multiple technologies available, genomics, proteomics, transcriptomics, metabolomics, panomics, all kinds of technologies, we go and interrogate these samples properly and trace our way back, Diane, we can figure out what germline, which means what kind of DNA they were born with that made them susceptible to develop this kind of disease in later life. So that we'd be able to trace back acute leukemia to pre-leukemia, and then looking at germline DNA of patients with pre-leukemia to see, okay, those individuals who developed, let's say, myelodysplastic syndrome affecting chromosome 5 had a polymorphism in this gene at birth.
Huh.
So now we can go to banks of public domains that contain DNA sequencing information on hundreds of thousands of healthy individuals, identify those with this kind of polymorphism, follow them and see, is there any evidence of early pre-leukemia in those people? So we go from acute leukemia to pre-leukemia to healthy volunteers. We have all the samples in the tissue repository ready to be studied. But where are the resources? Where is the will?
Dr. Raza, are you saying to me that an indication of leukemia that could appear later in life is present at birth?
I'm saying it is very possible. People have actually shown that many breast cancers start in utero. So, yes, I think there's a very good possibility, not all cases. But I do think that one possibility is to detect early in healthy volunteers through germline DNA. But there are other technologies that are becoming available that can constantly monitor the human body. Give you one simple example. As soon as a cancer starts, it has to attract nutrition to itself because it divides faster than normal cells. Nutrition is provided by blood vessels. So it starts making new blood vessels. The area becomes hot. Why can't we pick up this area that is hot through many of our imaging devices that can be worn like a telephone or a bed sheet that can scan you overnight and say, oh, in the head of the pancreas, there is a hot spot that's appeared.
What about the current cancer screenings, the colonoscopies, the mammograms? Have they not proven effective?
They are very effective, Diane. In fact, there is a 26% decline in mortality in the last several decades, and most of it is owed to early detection by mammograms and pap smears and PSAs and colonoscopies. In fact, 36% of these common cancers, reduction in mortality by 36% is owed to these techniques. But then they have their limitations. They can sometimes detect cancers very early that may never kill the individual in their lifetime. If you detect a prostate cancer in an 80-year-old, that's going to take 30 years to grow into a truly malignant killer, then that's not really very helpful. But I'm saying we should use the latest cutting-edge technologies to actually supplement what we are doing with the current screening measures.
If you would explain the debate over the primeval cause of cancer, whether it actually begins as a genetic mutation of a cell or as a cell with an incorrect number of chromosomes.
You sound like a scientist now.
No, I am quoting from your book.
Yes. I think it's very clear to everyone that no matter what the cause around it, whether it's the environment of the cell which is toxic, or whether it is an actual damage to the cell itself directly, whether it's seed or soil, in other words, the end result is that the functioning of the cell becomes abnormal. And because the function of the cell is controlled by genes and their expression, so either there is a mutation in a gene or a gene is dysfunctional, it is producing too much protein or too much message or too little. It is shut off for odd reasons. And so in the final analysis, ultimately, it always has to be a genetic component to things. There is a debate whether it's whole chromosomes that are damaged or just small genes. But in the end, it's just the functioning. And my own bias is that there are very rare cancers that are caused by single genetic abnormalities. Most of them have already been identified, and for them targeted and magic bullet type drugs have been or treatments have been developed. But the vast majority of cancers are either due to aneuploidy or too much damage in the microenvironment of the cell, as well as the cell. It's a very complicated issue.
Yes.
And the single most complicating is that once a cancer cell forms, every time it divides, the cell has to double its DNA, and during that doubling, it can make copying errors in the DNA. A copying error that occurs is called a mutation. So each time a cancer cell divides, it picks up new mutations. In other words, it can become a new cancer now. So there's constant selection pressures, there's constant evolution, it's a moving target.
How optimistic are you, Dr. Raza, that the kinds of changes that you want to see happen in our understanding and treatment of cancer actually will happen?
If I say very optimistic, people will beat down on me that, oh, I'm just being as unrealistic as the past researchers have been. I think I am realistic in saying that, look, so far the strategies we have developed are too toxic, they are too expensive, they're not helping enough patients, and they're causing a lot of suffering, and frankly, they are insupportable now at many levels, not just financial. At physical levels, they are becoming insupportable. I don't understand why we are developing therapies where we have to constantly ask ourselves, will the disease cancer kill the patient, or the treatment I'm going to give the patient will kill?
Yes.
I think that is just unacceptable. So the point I'm making is we should at least acknowledge that the current cancer paradigm is failing. And if that is failing, what other strategy can be used? The only strategy that has really worked has been early detection. I just quoted the numbers for all the screening measures we talked about, which have saved millions of lives already. And I feel very optimistic in one area, which is that this is a capitalist country. Once we set a goal and we financially incentivize it, everyone will rush towards it. So if we just say that, look, early detection is our goal, how can we find it? Should you develop some proteomics markers, genomics, transcriptomics, whatever markers, liquid biopsies, imaging technology, wearable devices, what can you come up with? I think the competition will be immense.
Dr. Raza, thank you so much for joining us. This was so helpful, educational, and I'm sure many people fully agree that some new approach needs to occur and occur soon. Thank you again.
Thank you, Diane. It's been an honor being with you, and I'm a big admirer of your podcast. So really an honor. Thanks.
Thank you. That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineers this week are Josephine Neonai and Natalie Yurev-Lifker. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.